This is a podcast from the British Council's Going Global 2013.
I think we make a start because we are quite short of time. A warm welcome to all of you and thank you very much for joining. I was asked to make clear this is the panel on transnational education and not on strategic partnerships. If you want to listen to strategic partnerships, you have to move the room. Okay? Obviously, everything worked fine. Over 25 years have passed since the pioneering days of cross-border or transnational education. Nonetheless, the sector continues to grow rapidly, and with it, the challenges for higher education institutions and policy have grown likewise. Australian universities were among the first higher education providers to invest abroad, with British and American higher education institutions following close behind. Others, as for example Germany, started around the year 2000 to explore systematically the opportunities to be found in the international higher education market with its own approach of German-backed universities. Still, we all do observe a huge demand in higher education. As we all know, the figure of 7 million young mobile people in the year 2025 to come looking for higher education worldwide. Nevertheless, there's a clear trend from mobility of people to mobility of programs. There are already more than 500,000 students studying at home in programs provided from universities abroad. Numbers are increasing year by year, also increasing the number of branch campuses abroad. We just learned that China is jumping in as well. This might build up a campus in Egypt and in other places. Many papers discussed the pros and cons of institutions going abroad. In this panel, we do ask the other way around. What is the motivation of host countries to invite institutions of higher education from abroad? What are their expectations, policies, and interest? Will it be a long-lasting development or just a phase to build up own institutions? Or are these developments part of a strategy of privatization in the field of higher education and substitute government activities and funding? Or will capacity development in the end make TNE projects redundant? TNE, will it just be a part of a transformation process on a path to a knowledge society with the aim to build global partnerships and networks in the long run in education and might be research hubs? Or will we see a globalization of knowledge where places are getting more and more redundant, like with MOOCs or other forms of virtual campuses? How will the future look like? Is it a bubble or an alternative to build a knowledge society where glocals, this word I like so much, can gain high-class education, global aspirations with local experiences, as The Guardian called it? This, I hope, we can discuss in the next 1 hour, I would say. And the four colleagues here on the stage will present parts of their joint research. Therefore, I would propose to present it all together and only have very urgent questions in between. We should concentrate on a discussion after the four presentations. Now I would like to introduce the first speaker, Kevin Van Korter. I hope it's okay. He's a specialist in higher education and is higher education advisor to the British Council and a specialist, of course, in TNE. He will give a kind of mapping of transnational education. He will introduce definitions, what is really a very important but tough business. And he will give us some data. And I think there's lots of room for improvement. I think we all agree on that. So, Kevin, please, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dorothea. So welcome to the launch of the British Council of Research, The Shape of Things to Come, The Evolution of Transnational Education. You should all have a flyer on your seats. The flyer gives you a link to a web page where you can download the research highlights, which are available as of today online, which will give you a summary of the research that we have done. The full research report will be published in May, so look out for that. But as I say, you can download the executive summary as of today, and the links are on the flyers on your seats. I just wanted to introduce the team very briefly who've worked on this project, because we are from quite diverse backgrounds, and I think it's important to understand the different people who have been working on this project so you can see where we're all coming from. Myself, as Dorothea said, I am a higher education advisor at the British Council. I've tracked trends in UK transnational education data for the last 10 years or so. Roslini is from Malaysia. She is Hope University College, a practitioner and a researcher. Jane Knight, an academic and a researcher. And we have John McNamara, an economist. So we have a range of people with different perspectives on transnational education, and we hope that together we've come up with some very interesting research. Okay, what were the objectives of the study? The objectives were very much to contribute to an improved understanding of TNE activities globally. And one of the first things we've done, and what I'm going to talk about very briefly, is we've analysed all available data and definitions of transnational education from around the world. We've done that so that we've got a thorough understanding of what is and isn't available. The second objective is to provide an insight into the impact of TNE on host countries and the local communities. We've done case studies which look at three specific countries to look really at the impact of TNE on the host country. And what we're doing then is bringing all this evidence together. What we aim to do is project future demand for TNE and identify countries most likely to seek or expand engagement through TNE. So we're looking at a host country perspective, why countries want to engage with TNE, what the opportunities are for host countries to develop transnational education partnerships. Okay, so what we did. We did an analysis of TNE definitions and data. We analysed demand the demand side from students to look at in 50 countries, and John will talk in more detail about this when it comes to his part of the presentation. We produced an opportunities matrix for TNE for 25 countries, and again, John will talk about that. And we did three in-depth case studies, and colleagues will talk about those as we go through the presentation. So that's really the core elements of the work. And the key messages from the research. So this is really the beginning at the end of the beginning, if you like, but this is really what the key things we found from the work we've done. And I think it's worth putting that right at the beginning so you can see, you know, where we're coming from and really what the key messages are from our research. The key messages are that the regulatory framework in a country is absolutely essential for TNE to develop. That the framework being an enabling framework, which is flexible, but which looks at issues of policy, of openness to foreign providers, issues of quality assurance and regulation, and that framework is essential for TNE to develop. We found also that data is very poor. I mean, that's quite clear. TNE is evolving and complex, and it's often unique to the host country environment. And the case studies really show, I think, those three countries we studied, in any case, that the impacts of TNE in those countries have tended to match national policies. So what we've seen is that countries which have developed policies, why do they want TNE in their country? Why do they want branch campuses and foreign provision? And generally we found from the three case studies that the development of TNE has matched those expectations. And we'll talk about this in a bit more detail as we go through. Okay, so onto the definitions, we did look, did a thorough literature review to really try and understand what the definitions are out there of TNE, to try and come to our own conclusions and to synthesise this, the data that's available on definitions. Various international bodies have tracked TNE and tried to define transnational education. So for some examples here, there was a Lisbon Recognition Convention, UNESCO OECD guidelines. Some of them are quite specific to specific types of TNE. Some of them are broader. Some of the definitions are quite broad. There are others, Jane Knight here, has back in 2004 looked at TNE from the perspective of internationalisation. So different people have tried to define TNE in different ways. TNE is referred to in a number of different ways as well in different countries, so it's referred to as cross-border higher education or offshore higher education. There are GATS classifications of transnational education. So there are lots of international attempts to define TNE. But the most important concept which we've used for this research is for TNE is that the learners are located in a different country to the awarding institution or one of the awarding institutions, and that's the key concept for us. And what we've done is we've taken... briefly talk about national definitions, because as well as international definitions, various countries have defined TNE. The British Council has a definition. The Chinese have defined TNE. They're all different definitions. They all include or exclude certain types of provision because they're based on what a country sees as TNE or what it sees as important in terms of transnational education. Most international definitions include distance learning in TNE, except Australia. India defines it slightly differently. So there are lots of different national as well as international definitions. So our framework, we've called this the TNE 10. These are the 10 categories of TNE which we've, from synthesising the analysis that have been done by others over the last many years, we have come up with definitions which we're using, our framework, which we're then using to look at the opportunities. So we've classified TNE into 10 types. So you have institutional mobility, which is really about the branch campus model, what we call partner branch campus, which is a smaller branch campus or other types of campuses which maybe are not full branch campuses. Now the categories in a sort of a brown colour are the ones we have not included in this study, and I'll explain why, but it's mainly to do with issues around data, so we haven't included distance learning. Programme mobility, you have dual and double degrees, franchising, twinning, joint mobility, and then various other forms which we've excluded because they're not, by our definition, transnational education, because the student doesn't necessarily study for a foreign qualification in their home country. But we've classified TNE in this way. Now, the problem, what we've then done is looked at TNE data. So we have done a thorough analysis of TNE data in 50 countries, or looked for TNE data in 50 countries. We did a lot of analysis, was a lot of desk-based research, finding out what was available from the 50 countries we'd selected as being the top potential markets, if you like, for TNE. Of these, only 3 sending countries published TNE data, so that is Australia, Germany, and the UK. And 7 receiving countries published TNE data. So one of the key conclusions from this is that there is a lack of data available on transnational education. So many countries, there is TNE going on, but there's no data available from either the host or sending countries. So the 7 countries that publish data, we've analysed that data in full: China, Hong Kong, Malaysia, Mauritius, Singapore, Thailand, and Vietnam. So just briefly then, some of the data we found, there's just a couple of slides on this, so I'll do very quick highlights. UK publishes full data on our provision overseas, and we've done a lot of analysis on that data, as does Australia, and we also have very good data from Germany, so the key numbers are there. You'll be able to download this presentation afterwards to get all the details. In terms of receiving countries, in China there are 700 clubs programs, in Hong Kong 1,144 non-local programs, so you can see that some countries have quite significant numbers of transnational programs. And that's data for some of the other countries. And just a couple of very quick final points. in this research, we've taken as our starting point transnational education in all its different forms, and then we've looked at the different environments in which it operates. So that's the perspective we've taken. We haven't produced a ranking of countries, and that's very important. We've looked at opportunities for countries to develop as host countries for TNE, but we've not ranked countries. John, as an economist, will talk about the way we've done this, but it's very important to say we've not ranked countries. And the aim of the research is really so that it can be used by host countries seeking to develop transnational education as host countries, and by providers and institutions who are looking to develop new programmes in new markets. Thank you.
Okay. Kevin, thank you so much. Frankly speaking, I hope there are no urgent questions. Are there? No. Great. So now I have the great honor, I must say, to introduce Jane Knight. Actually, I think I don't have to introduce her because you all know her. Many of us, we use her definition of internationalization. On my list, you are the second.
Okay, we'll see what happens with the slides.
Okay, we will see. Otherwise, we will switch. We are very flexible. You know, she is adjunct professor to University of Toronto, an expert in internationalization and TNE, of course. And the research she has done, for the last few months, is on education hubs, actually. So let's have a look. Who will appear here now? Which presentation?
Let me just go.
Oh, sorry.
See what happened. Mm-hmm. I think it is Jane.
It's perfect, Jane. It's your turn.
Great.
No way.
Thank you, sorry.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here and to be part of this team and report on some of our findings. The interesting point is that my job is to talk about the case study that we have done in the UAE and a little bit broader in the Gulf countries. The challenge is, and of course it is from the receiving country perspective. Now, it's clear I'm not from the Gulf, nor am I from a receiving country. So I do say that for those of you in the audience who are from this region, we welcome very much your comments and suggestions at the end. So, the key messages that I would like to emphasize are, one, in the Gulf region, the six countries in the Gulf, international branch campuses are really the key to TNE activity. And hence, the analysis that I will be presenting will be based on branch campuses. Secondly, that there are a real diversity of rationales that are driving the receiving or the host countries. Why are they interested in having TNE? More specifically, why are they interested in branch campuses? Third key message is that there are a lot of issues and challenges. As much as we are looking at rationales and benefits, it is important to be cognizant that there are some unintended consequences and some risks as well. And I do believe that it's important we take a 360-degree view of that. So, let us take a quick overview of TNE in the Gulf. In Bahrain, there are three international branch campuses. The first one was in 2002, and I think it's important that we pay attention to the date because it does give us some indication of the maturity of that receiving country's experience in TNE. The data that we have is that between 50 and 75% of the students who are enrolled in the branch campuses are actually locals. Now, of course, in this region of the world, we have to be careful about what we define as local. Because, in fact, we are seeing that there are three types of students going to these branch campuses. One are local national citizens. Two are local expat population who have lived often in that country for most of their lives, but they are seen as an expat in our particular lingo. They are determined as an expat student. And then there are the international students who are coming from out of the country. So in Bahrain, we're seeing 50 to 75, and I would suggest that that includes both locals and expat population. In Kuwait, there are 2 international branch campuses and 5 twinning and affiliation programs. Saudi Arabia, of course, it is very active in international engagement, but not particularly in the field of branch campuses or even in the field of twinning programs or joint degrees. Oman is a very interesting country for us to look at. They are home to 1 binational university. And this is a definition that we did not include in our list of definitions because it's an evolving concept of binational universities. And however, Oman is home to one of them and to 1 branch campus. Qatar, 10 branch campuses. They're first in 1998. That means 15 years of experience with branch campuses and TNE, 50% are locals. Finally, it brings us to UAE, and that is going to be the focus of my talk, where, as we all have heard in the last few days, that they are home to 37 international branch campuses, the largest concentration of foreign branch campuses in the world. Interesting, in this country, we have been able to distinguish between local Emirati students, expat students who are living in the UAE, and international. And it is interesting to see that 5 to 10% are actually Emirati students. So let's look at some highlights from UAE. The most important thing is to look at context. I think that context is singularly the most important issue when we're looking at benefits of TNE, rationales of TNE, and maybe some of the risks and unintended consequences. Expats represent 85% of the 8 million population in UAE. No expat students are enrolled in federal higher education institutions. And there is a shift, a definite shift from a knowledge into a knowledge and service economy from their dependency on oil. There are 7 Emirates here. 3 or 4 of them are quite active in TNE. Here is an important point. There is no national UAE strategy around TNE, no real national set of regulations. TNE activity is being managed, is being governed, is being established by the regulatory frameworks at the Emirates level. And so when I do talk about benefits and drivers, please understand that they differ significantly between, for instance, Abu Dhabi and Dubai, or Abu Dhabi and Iraq. TNE activity, as I've mentioned, here are the breakdown of the 37 IBCs across the 3 Emirates. 60% are expat students, 33% international, about 7 local. Both Dubai and RAK, Ras Al Khaimah, have free trade zones. And this is something that we need to take into consideration when we are looking at the drivers and the benefits and the risks of branch campuses or TNE, whether they are located in a free trade zone. And while UAE is probably got the most branch campuses taking in free trade zones, they are not alone. Korea has a free trade zone, as does Malaysia, as does Qatar for the Science and Technology Park. So this is an element that we need to keep in mind in terms of the evolution of TNE. We are going to talk about the drivers. I would suggest, and I hope we can discuss this, that the drivers are 1, access, and especially, as you can see, for the expat population, a desire to build a skilled workforce, and yes, to have some status, some soft power, some competitiveness in the region. So what's interesting is to look at the where the international branch campuses are coming from. Is what region of the world are the sending countries? 13 of the 37 are coming from Asia, of which 10 are from India. Europe also has 13 sending countries, the UK being the most popular at 6. North America has 9, with UAS, with the US representing 8. And the Middle East, so much for regionality. Middle East has 2, 1 from Iran and 1 from Lebanon. This is an interesting finding that has implications about whether a branch campus or where a country has seeing its role both from a national point of view and also from serving the region. So the rationales and benefits differ by stakeholder group. It is really misleading if we talk about a single rationale or driving motivation for why a country is interested in TNE. There are the receiving countries' policies and priorities, whether it be public institution, public bodies, the government, or whether it be private, i.e. the trade zones. Of course, the sending country has, and the sending institution has its own rationales and benefits, as do our students who are enrolled in them, as do the local domestic higher education institutions that have a relationship with these international branch campuses. They are very much affected both positively and negatively in terms of branch campuses. And finally, the local employers. But the part of this study which I think was important is that we looked at our case studies from number one, the receiving country policies and priorities. So let's look at that from a generic point of view. The generic point of view is that many of the countries are looking for increased access for their local students and for their expat students. A second one is a desire to modernize, to internationalize, to expand their higher education sector, to do some capacity building. A third driving rationale is definitely related to generating income. Foreign students are a source of income for some countries, certainly branch campuses in their way. And this income, it's not only income, it's also attraction of foreign direct investment. HRD, the development of the students to attract, train, retain a skilled workforce. And it's certainly when we look at UAE, with 85% being expats, 60% being of students being expats, this is an important driving rationale. And finally, I think that we need to be robust in our perspective and look at some of the status, the soft power, the competitiveness rationales that are driving TNE and branch campuses. If we take a quick look at the issues and challenges that international branch campuses specifically, with the opportunity to generalize more broadly to TNE, I think the number one, or a number one issue, is the whole area of licensing, registration, quality assurance, and accreditation. And as I have mentioned, in UAE specifically, 27 of the 37 branch campuses are located in free trade zones. Part of the attraction of a free trade zone is some liberation in terms of regulatory environment, one of the resulting issues being quality assurance and accreditation. Equally important is the recognition of the qualification that is offered. By definition, a branch campus is offering a foreign degree, a foreign qualification. Not all TNE does, but by definition, a branch campus does. And it's extremely important that the qualification that the students have earned is being recognized for further study and for further and for employment. This is an area that I think perhaps needs to have more attention. Language proficiency, I think we've all heard in the last 2 days that there are 85 different languages being spoken in this country, for example. If you look at, am I okay? If we look at the branch campuses, I've visited many, many of them here, many of the students are taking their training in their second or third language. Cultural issues, values that inform pedagogy, values that inform the value, the importance of an education, relevance of the programs to the labor market. This is very important for UAE, given that their primary rationale, their primary driver is developing a skilled workforce. The programs have to be relevant to the labor market. Sustainability of branch campuses and TNE is extremely important, as is the issue of social cohesion. The social cohesion among the students in a branch campus, the social cohesion between the students, between local international, local institutions, as well as branch campuses. And finally, this whole issue of brain train, brain gain, and brain drain. So in conclusion, the key messages are that in the Gulf region, and specifically in this particular country, branch campuses are the key TNE activity. The variety of rationales and benefits, let me explain it. Let me emphasize again, we have not talked about risks and unintended consequences. They are equally as important. Access for students, improvement of the higher education sector or expansion, economic motivations, labor market, and status. The issues and challenges are diverse, including qualifications, quality assurance, curriculum relevance, social cohesion, and sustainability. Thank you very much.
So thank you so much, Jane. I think this was very exciting. We would like to ask many, many questions, but we have to go on. We have to rush through a little bit. Now we will move from the Gulf region to Southeast Asia, to Malaysia. And I'm very happy to introduce to you Dr. Rosildini Fernandez-Chung. She is Vice President of HELP University. I just learned it's quite a new university. It was established four years ago or something like that. And she is a very strong expert in the field of quality assurance, and she will give us some insights in the motivations and drivers in Malaysia. Rosildini.
Close, yes. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me? Yes? Okay. Sleepy? Okay. Good. I didn't hear a no, so it must be sleepy. Okay. I'm here to tell you a story, and I think many of us would say, it's Malaysia, I've heard it many times, so you know. I started with the same, perhaps, viewpoint, perception, when John asked us to participate in this particular group and study TNE. But I learned so much about Malaysian TNE that I'm ashamed to say my earlier presentations on TNE Malaysia should all be thrown out of the window. So I'm here to tell you a story. Now, time is really very short, and I would like to give more time for Q&A. So I will try and limit myself to about 8 minutes. Rather than 10. Yeah, so let me see if I can do this. Now, let me take you back to Kevin's slide, and I think that would probably be the most important thing that you must take back with you. There are three things you wanted to do in this particular study. One, or three things that we learned from this study. One, regulatory framework is absolutely essential for TNE. No two ways about it. Number two, TNE data, dismal. poor, dismal, really bad. Now, if you think Malaysia has been in T&E for almost literally about 35, 40 years, and we would have some sufficient or enough data out there, you are wrong, because it is so difficult to get T&E data, even for Malaysia. And the difficulty just does not just lie with getting data, but getting reliable data and consistent data. Because if you go to one ministry, you get X, and you go to another ministry, you get Y. That's the problem. Now, the third one is, what was it? Okay, T&E meeting national aspirations. Now, this is absolutely true for Malaysia, but I would like to take you beyond this to say, what has T&E done, and how would T&E shape the future of Malaysian higher education? So, forgive me if I don't take you through every slide, but these slides are available, I'm told, so you could read them through, but I'll just give you a gist of what I would like to share with you today. If this works... No, it's going back.
Going backwards. The green one.
Green one, yes. Mm-hmm.
The green center button.
All right, let's go.
No.
Good. Okay, here we are. Okay. Now, apologies. Title's wrong. The past that shapes the future. We are not so much in the future that we can say future is past. Huh? So, the past that shapes the future. Okay. Let me just very quickly run through this, and then I'll skip some of the slides in front. Now, for Malaysia, T&E certainly came in because the national higher education system, i.e. the public universities, did not have sufficient space for Malaysian students. And then for a very long time, Malaysians used to travel specifically, I would think, particularly to UK to get their higher qualifications. And sometime in the early 70s, the government decided to allow what we call second chance institutions, Help Us One of them. We were formed in 1986. These second chance institutions provided what we call distance learning programs to students who could not enter into the universities. Hence, private universities were called second chance institutions. Yeah? Today, they're no longer second chance. And I'll tell you, that is because of T&E. Now, and after, sometime in the early or mid-90s, with the minister who is now the Prime Minister of Malaysia, Datuk Najib, there was this great liberalisation of the private higher education sector. Now, why do I say liberalisation of the private higher education sector influenced T&E? Because T&E in Malaysia is largely, perhaps almost 90% in the private higher education sector. So these are the two main factors that caused T&E to bloom in the country. Now, what are the characteristics? And I've listed down some of these. The T&E is regulated by MOHE, same regulation, whether you're a domestic provider, domestic program, or international program. It covers all levels from undergraduate to PhD, and I'll show you some data later on. It's mainly UK and Australia. We somehow love UK and Australia. We have a couple of programs from Switzerland, you know, America, but largely UK and Australia. Various modalities. We have branch campuses, faculties, franchises, etc. Now, they're largely within the private and for-profit organization. And I think this is really important for Malaysia. It actually tells you the character of T&E in Malaysia. Yeah? And 15.2% of our programs in the private sector are T&E programs. This is the data taken from Malaysian Qualifications Register as of December 2012, so 15.2%. Yeah. Now, before we go into franchise programs, just let me tell you that we do have international branch campuses. At the moment, we have listed about 7, I think, and the dates are there. You can go through them, you know, and you know who they are. I think Nottingham is also here. You would know Nottingham is here. But T&E Malaysia started with franchise programs, that's for sure. That was the first program that actually established itself. We used to have articulation programs. We used to have 2 plus 1, 1 plus 2. And then later on, it went up to 3 plus 0 or 4 plus 0. Now, if you look at the data, it shows you that there are no T&E programs at the doctoral level. If you see, at the doctoral level, it shows 0, right? 0%. But that's really, really not very true. And I'll tell you why. We have what we call institutions that are within the radar of the ministry, i.e. they are institutions registered with the Ministry of Higher Education, and therefore, to run a program, whether it's homegrown or foreign program, they will have to get the approval from the ministry. Now, these programs are listed. But we do have institutions that, what we call, we won't call them institutions. Let's call them training center. But something that bugs me, loves me. Sorry. Okay. Now, we have institutions that I would call outside the ministry radar. These would be training centers. It absolutely got scared of you, Kevin. It went off. Okay, these are institutions outside the ministry radar, and these institutions are training centres. They offer online DBAs and PhDs and MBAs. So they are not calculated in this list. Yeah. So these are those within the ministry's radar. Now, if you look at masters, it's about 15%. But interestingly, the bachelor's level degree, there are about one-third of bachelor level degrees in Malaysia offered in the private higher education institutions, about 500 of them. These are TNE programs. It's how strong they are, yeah? And then the rest is there for you to see. Let me very quickly look at it. Now, what are the benefits of TNE? And of course, in Malaysia, what are the impact of these? Now, academic quality, there is a perception that TNE programs are better. Whether this perception is true or not true, we don't know. A group of us are trying to get some funds. Anybody would like to fund? We're willing to talk to you. But we're trying to get some fundings to compare and see employer perceptions of TNE programs against homegrown programs. So perhaps next year, Going Global, I'll come and share with you the findings. Or Chris can do that. Now, I'll go on to the next one. Certainly, there is a greater understanding, I think, in after 20, 30 years of TNE between home providers and host providers like us. Now, economic impact, there is no doubt TNE helps us out. Financially, it's really good. We are bringing in a lot of students. We are stamping in, we have about close to about 90,000 international students today, largely from China and Middle East. Indonesians' number, they are reducing, but certainly there's a large number. Certainly, we stamp the outflow of currency. Students are no longer going to overseas in large numbers as they used to before. I think UK gets about 12,000 at the moment every year, so, you know, the numbers are dwindling, going down. But certainly they are doing the program in Malaysia, so that's good. Now, what is more important about TNE in Malaysia is that it provides access to education to students in the rural areas. Even though 75% of TNE programs are private institutions are in the Klang Valley, i.e. Kuala Lumpur and surrounding areas, but a lot of TNE programs are now mushrooming outside the Klang Valley, which is good. So there is access to students in the more rural areas. Access is certainly the most important impact of TNE from the Malaysian perspective. And I think certainly this contribution to community. Now, Nottingham can give you some very warm stories about how TNE has helped build the community around that area. You know, they get involved with the community issues, garbage disposal, Borga, you know, this nuclear plant that they wanted to do. Now, these things comes up and it's really interesting how they get involved in it. So this is really good for TNE Malaysia. Now, status and ranking, no indication to say that TNE has pushed Malaysian universities up in test ranking, but certainly there is this indication that Malaysia is now a global leader in TNE because of TNE providers in the country. I'm not going to say much, I'm going to skip through this. HR, no doubt about it, there is direct benefit. Capacity building has always been one of the themes in collaboration, TNE collaboration in Malaysia. Right. There is this element of brain drain, I'm told. But certainly, when it comes to politics, however, you don't see direct involvement of TNE purely because in Malaysia, students are not supposed to get involved in politics. I say not supposed to, but they do. But there is a legislation preventing students from getting involved in politics. Yeah, so TNE providers don't get involved in politics too. Now, let me just very quickly summarize whatever that we learned about Malaysia. The first one, there is this element of foreign presence against foreign influence. Foreign presence is seen with the establishment of branch campuses. Nottingham, Curtin, Swinburne, you know, Reading, Southampton, so on. Foreign influence is seen with the franchise programs that is established in Malaysia, franchise collaborative programs, joint degrees, i.e. the university, the foreign university is not present directly in the country, but it is present through a partner in the country. So there is what we call a foreign influence, yeah? Now, TNE is good, really, for providing access, for building capacity. We know that, stemming outflow of currency, building nations. Certainly, it has helped build Malaysia, attracting foreign students. 73% of our international students are in the private sector, with estimated 6% in branch campuses. So you can imagine the 50-odd percent is actually in some sort of franchise programs. This is how big TNE in Malaysia is, yeah? And, of course, there is this element of brain gain at the moment. But more importantly, what is the way forward? And I think people have asked me this question many times. Should we now take this route of going into branch campuses and establishing more and more branch campuses, or should we go down back to the early days and encourage collaboration and franchise? Now, the answer, I don't have the answer, to be honest. But what I know for sure is this. Branch campus is good for research. It helps a lot of collaboration. We have a lot of collaboration at branch campuses. And it helps bring in experts from two different fields, two different jurisdictions, to look at things from a different angle. That's really good. It contributes to QA and policy development because of faculty presence. And I can tell you this, during my MQA days, every time we had an expert panel, a stakeholder panel, we had a representative from the foreign branch campus. Basically, in Malaysia, we say the orang putih, in the orang putih mean white man, in the panel. So that was really important. We always had the expert present in the panel. There is this concept of brain gain. There are lots of people coming back to work in Malaysia, and they usually work in the branch campuses, which is good. Yeah, there is this access to rural areas and areas which are not popular. And I'll tell you why. Because the ministry tells you that if you want to set up a branch campus, it has to be at Iskandar Corridor down south, or Seminyak, like where Nottingham is, or in Sarawak, where Swinburne and Curtin is. So branch campuses are not going to mushroom in and around the Klang Valley. It's going to be further away from the Klang Valley. And of course, this element of science and technology with people coming in. Yeah? You okay for time? No? Okay. Two. All right. Now, so franchise, this is my final statement. So between branch campus and franchise, I would think franchise is still the best way to test the viability of TNE in Malaysia. Now, if you're not so sure of a partner, franchise is a better way because it means low risk, high return, and it certainly supports capacity building. And with that, I thank you. Thank you very much.
Vasilini, thank you so much.
You've lived this day for such a long time, John. Yeah.
I was always so impressed by the very clear strategy of Malaysia as far as TNE is concerned. Now we switch and we will have a look at the different opportunities for transnational education, and we might get some examples from China as well. So I would like to introduce John McNamara. He worked for Economist Intelligence Unit in London, and he is now a free consultant on international education. The floor is yours.
Thanks very much.
Oh, don't let it on the green one, yeah.
Remakasi.
Okay. Good afternoon. Thanks very much, guys. So I think what we've seen so far is Kevin has given an overview of the first chunk of the research, which dealt with definitions and data. And Rosalini and Jane have given an overview of the second piece of the research, which looked at the impact of TNE on host countries. And the important thing there is that we were looking at it from the perspective of host countries, which has, you know, there's a gap in the literature in that respect. There will also be a third case study in the final report to do with the impacts of TNE on China, so that will be coming up as well. I'm going to present on the third part of the research, which this is where we've tried to analyse and determine which countries have the most conducive environments for TNE to develop and to grow going forward. We've thrown the net fairly wide. We've included exactly 25 countries in the analysis. Generally, these are countries that we know have at least some existing activity going on. There's not very much point in looking at countries that are doing nothing. We've included a couple of... There's been a human element to this as well. We've sat down, we've talked about which countries look to be doing something interesting or exciting. But we have thrown the net fairly wide, which is important. We didn't want to rank countries. Rather, we wanted to assign them to opportunity groups. We think that sometimes rankings tend to have people focus on who comes top and who comes bottom, and a lot of the actual underlying analysis gets lost. So we think it's more important to categorize countries that are similar in some respects. We're looking for relationships across the data. We're looking to highlight the main trends and some examples of innovative approaches to TNE. This slide shows the methodology we used. We've basically focused. We've looked at this from three different perspectives. We've looked at the regulatory environment, which is clearly important. It's important for potential entrants to know whether they can establish operations, so it brings certainty. It's important for potential students of T&E programs to understand whether their programs will be accredited and recognised. We've also looked. So that's kind of like the supply side of the equation, if you like. We've also looked at it from the demand side of the equation. We've tried to analyse what are the factors that indicate demand for T&E within host countries, both demand from the potential students and also demand from the higher education institutions themselves to reach out and link with foreign providers. This has been a more difficult category. I'll talk about it a bit later on. We're also interested to look at what's happening now. This is clearly countries that have already become internationalised to some degree, whether it's student mobility, branch campus mobility. That kind of activity and momentum can often perpetuate itself into the future. So we're interested to see what countries are doing right now. So I'm just going to talk about the regulatory environment first. This really constituted the bulk of the research because all of the indicators are qualitative. So we had to sit down and research and score all of the indicators ourselves. And as I said, there were 25 countries, 13 underlying scoring criteria for each country. I'm not going to really focus on who came where or why, how individual countries did. I think it's more interesting, and given the time constraints, to talk about the main themes that have emerged from the research, the main findings. One of the indicators was strategy. We looked at the existence of dedicated agencies to drive and promote T&E. We looked at the existence of incentives. We looked at whether strategies were published. And what we can say about these is that there typically aren't dedicated agencies to drive T&E in these countries. But what there are is there are quite often units within the Ministry of Higher Education that have promoting inbound T&E as part of their remit. So it won't be their only remit, but it'll be part of their remit. But what was interesting to see as well is that T&E is quite often framed within an economic rather than an educational context. And so some of the bodies that are promoting T&E in Qatar, for example, and Singapore and here in Dubai are economic development boards rather than ministries of education. So that was interesting to see that. And that takes the research into different areas. So you're not just looking on Ministry of Education websites, you're looking on economic and finance websites. And so that was important for the research to understand that kind of early on. It's important to say as well, the T&E, of course, is not necessarily an important objective for some of the countries in the study. So we're looking at one part of the big picture of internationalisation here. We're looking at inbound T&E, but there's a whole lot more going on with student mobility and outbound T&E. So, I mean, there are countries in this study that may appear that they haven't much going on with T&E, but it's because it's just not for them. It's not, for whatever reason, it's not a policy priority. As Jane mentioned about UAE not having a strategy, this is actually a universal thing we've discovered across all of the countries. Not one of the 25 countries have what you could say is a strategy document that has been produced with clear goals and clear objectives. This does happen from the sending country perspective we've seen, but it doesn't seem to certainly there's no defined documents as such. But that's not to say there aren't initiatives and programs in place to drive T&E. So, and none more obvious than the development of T&E hubs. And in this respect, some of the countries have been very successful. And you can look at the likes of Singapore and South Korea and Qatar and here in Dubai as well. Quite a lot of success in this area. But other countries have made attempts and maybe not been as successful. And so, you know, some countries have made quite big statements about developing hubs, but it's been maybe a bit more difficult to realise that over time. And Bahrain has worked towards it. Botswana has worked towards it and is working towards it. You can look on the Sri Lankan Ministry of Education website. You'll see that Sri Lanka wants to be the most cost-effective and high-quality regional hub in its region. But to find information beyond that is sometimes quite difficult. So there are differences in what's been achieved on that front. T&E incentives are definitely very important. We've seen some examples of some significant incentives to attract branch campuses, to attract foreign providers into the countries. And you look at Qatar, where buildings and operational funding is provided. Mauritius and here in the UAE, the tax environment is very favourable. You can repatriate profits, low corporation tax rates and so on. Singapore have given some pretty large financial grants to foreign branch campuses. Vietnam has given land grants. And then other countries are doing something, but not as much. The incentives in Malaysia are not as generous. In Spain, it tends to happen at the regional level. So we've seen an example of the Berklee School of Music being given land in Valencia to set up their campus. So quite a lot going on the T&E strategy indicator. Establishment of T&E regulations. So it's clearly important as to whether T&E branch, whether foreign branch campuses are allowed to establish. And mostly we've seen that, with the exception of only four countries, there's some regulatory systems in place to allow for that to happen. Sometimes it's quite difficult to find out exactly what's going on because it's couched in the terms of private higher educations rather than specifically referring to foreign providers. And those that aren't, that don't have strategy or don't have regulations in place are working towards that. But one of the points that came up is that it's not very easy in some countries to implement these regulations. It can take a long time. It can face considerable opposition. And we've seen even in the likes of India how long it's been debated in their parliament. Sri Lanka had a lot of difficulty in implementing a Private Higher Education Act and had to back down, actually. Indonesia passed theirs, but in the face of, you know, a lot of opposition. Turkey are going through it at the moment. And it's looking like that branch campuses will be allowed as long as they bring with them a lot of foreign students. So not just as simple as saying set up the regulations, it's quite difficult. Collaborative programmes, there's a little bit less focus in the regulations on collaborative activity, in that you don't see mention of validation agreements or franchise arrangements or joint degrees. And this is linked back to the definitional issues that we've seen. Countries don't, there aren't really an agreed framework for understanding how the different modes of T&E are defined, and that impacts on the ability to regulate collaborative activity. T&E is not dependent on regulations. We've seen lots of examples of where T&E has taken off in the absence of regulations, but our research suggests that there's a kind of a complex push and pull relationship between initial activity, response by the policymakers, then more activity, and ultimately more sustainable development of T&E going forward. So while it isn't a requirement for initial activity, it is important going forward. Another development we notice, which is worthy of mention, is this tendency of countries to start publishing lists of preferred foreign providers. So China have a list of institutions that they say these are who we want to partner with. Russia has a list. Thailand differentiates between top-ranked universities and lower. So this is something that's arisen out of the use of global rankings. And it's possibly something of concern, maybe, because countries may be selecting partner institutions on the basis of where they're ranked rather than what they can bring to the country in terms of the skills gaps that they can help the country to meet, the research that they can produce. Quality assurance. Quality assurance is definitely improving, and there's evidence of an experience dividend here. Countries that have been involved in T&E for quite a while tend to have the best systems. I just wanted to highlight something that's going on in Malaysia that's quite interesting, and this is where they have a self-accrediting system in place that once foreign providers have been through a couple of successful rounds of quality assurance, they can then apply to be self-accrediting, so that each individual new program that they introduce doesn't have to go through the process again. So it's about building trust between the institution and the regulators, and it seems to be working quite well. One of the things that's happening from the improving quality assurance framework frameworks that we're seeing across countries is an improving collection of T&E data. Now, as Kevin very correctly said, T&E data is very hard to come by. I started looking at T&E data about 3 years ago, and the only countries that were producing it then were Australia and the UK. 3 years later, Germany is now producing data, and there are seven host countries that are producing data, largely on the back of requirements for those programs to be registered with the Ministry of Higher Education. So Mauritius has pretty good data. Thailand is producing data. Vietnam, Malaysia. There are seven altogether. So, you know, the data situation is quite poor, but it is improving slowly, which is interesting. T&E recognition environment, of the different indicators we've looked at, this is probably the one where there's room for more activity to take place. Generally, there's not examples of massive amounts being done here, but there are individual examples of good practice. So in the case of Hong Kong, for example, Hong Kong probably does the most to send out a signal to the employment market and to the higher education market that once T&E programs are accredited and recognised, that they're exactly the same as domestic qualifications. There's no difference. And so that's interesting to see. Malaysia doesn't differentiate between T&E and its own domestic higher education system. It treats it as the same. There's also evidence of increasing development of quality equivalence qualifications equivalence systems. So this is a bit like the Bologna process in Europe. Other countries are kind of doing the same thing. I think Oman, Qatar has developed one, and Oman is developing one at the moment. So when we pull the regulatory scores together, these are the groups that the countries are assigned to. These scores are on the basis of standard deviations from the mean scores. So I think probably not surprising to see countries like Hong Kong and Malaysia and Singapore, UAE, coming in the top group. But interesting to see countries like Mauritius and Botswana doing as much as they're doing. I certainly wasn't aware of it before this research. I think also important to say that countries that are in the lower groups, you know, it's for a variety of reasons. It can often be that it's, as I said earlier on, it's not particularly important for them right now. They may be relative latecomers to the T&E scene. But according to our framework, they have their regulations are not as well developed as the countries in the higher groups. Market environment. So this is looking at demand for T&E. So this is more difficult to do. There are lots of things we would have liked to include here that are not possible because of data gaps, lack of data. But I think I'm going to skip forward a little bit, because what we've found here is that generally the framework we've put together to analyse the market environment maps pretty well with the regulatory environment. So the countries that come top of the market environment are the same countries that come top of the regulatory environment, and there's no reason to a priori reason to assume that that would be the case. It's also allowed us to identify countries that have what we measure to be is fairly favourable demand environments, but not necessarily the regulatory environment to support that. And so there are some countries like India and Turkey and Oman that, according to our analysis, if their regulations were developed further, there could be more activity happening. This is the market environment groups. As I said, I'm not really going to get into why certain countries come where they come. The final reports that we publish will go into more detail in that regard. This is just a graph to show how the regulatory results compare with the market results. And you can see that there is a reasonable correlation between the two. So when we pull the I've skimmed past the mobility environment there, but when we pull the three categories together, this is the overall results that we get. I think the graph there gives a good indication of the geographical scope of the study. The colours are probably a bit hard to make out. Some of the high-scoring countries are very small. But again, the report will go into more detail why each country has scored where it has. But the important point is that we can explain on the basis of data that we've pulled together why countries are where they are. And we're not saying that we've built a perfect framework. We've operated with considerable data challenges, I would say more data challenges than would be normal for, you know, a project like this. That's just a feature of the T&E landscape that we have to operate with. So again, just to recap on the main findings, regulations are important.
He's okay.
The most developed systems, the most developed T&E countries have the most developed regulations. They're not necessarily easy to implement. T&E is complex, it's evolving, it's data poor, data is improving very slowly. We have evidence that T&E is meeting many of the objectives as outlined in our case studies. And we have some evidence that if more development were made on the regulatory front, that there are unrealised potentials from the demand side of the equation. That's basically it, really.
John, thanks. Thank you so much. This was a marvellous framework, very complex issue. And you stop with questions and answers. So we have just a few minutes left, yeah?
Well,
two, five or so. Hmm? Now it's your turn. Who would like to ask the first question? There's a okay. The gentleman over there is first. I would say we collect three or four and then we will answer.
Mark Spearing from the University of Southampton, and as was mentioned, we just started operating a campus in Iskandar in Malaysia, and actually a very positive experience for us. Something I hadn't heard mentioned in any of the talks, and maybe the panelists would like to comment, is in terms of what the host country is trying to get out of it and also what makes it attractive for a potential entrant into a T&E relationship, particularly around branch campuses. A key consideration, or two key considerations for us, were the K through 12 education system and its readiness to feed into a T&E, and also as a major research university delivering a research-led education, actually having a research ecosystem that we could come into was a very big part of our consideration for where we decided to offer. So the panel might want to comment on the importance of those considerations, both for the host and the incoming or partner from in our case, the UK.
Okay, and perhaps the two in front here.
Hello, my name is Sajid Ashraf, and I do educational strategy with TCOM Investments. So I just wanted to say that, first of all, we are actually looking at collecting transnational data, and we're differentiating it from residential, which we're qualifying as students that are residing in the UU and when they make their application. So residential being local as well as expat. The other thing I wanted to mention is that we have as DEAC and TCOM, commissioned a study to determine skill gaps in the workforce, and that's actually now informing our strategy in terms of programs that we're seeking out. My question was specific to the Malaysian model. One of the challenges we have here with the for-profit model is how do we encourage research within that model? So could you perhaps give us some pointers as to how you facilitated that in Malaysia? Thank you.
Okay, this second question, short one.
Oh, very good.
Hi, I'm Rahul from World Education Services in New York. Fascinating presentation. My question is to Rosalini and Jane, specifically from the receiving country perspective. What do you think is the reason that U.S. is much lesser represented, U.S. institutions, as compared to Australian and the British universities? So what could be the factor in terms of American institutions not showing as much interest as compared to also the other institutions showing more interest? What could be the drivers?
Would you like to start with Alex? First one?
Yeah.
Okay, so okay. You make a start, Kevin?
Okay, I think we'll start with the issue of the school level environment. Correct me if I'm wrong, John, but I think that would come into the market environment section. Yeah. So there's been an analysis there of the demand, which takes into account the level of education that students have and the readiness for higher education and the propensity of the population at that age to study for international qualifications. So that's covered. I don't know if it's specifically one of the factors, but I think it's covered in that general environment. I'll leave the research for colleagues, but I just wanted to mention the US, if that's okay. I think the US is interesting. my impression is that the US is not particularly interested in developing TNE. Why that is a very difficult question. There are some US universities around the world, but there are different models. US institutions obviously have campuses where the US students come over to Europe to study for a summer school. But as far as I'm aware, most US universities, it's not on their radar. I don't know why. I can't really answer the question, but I think it is true.
Okay, and the other question goes to you, Rossellini.
Okay, I'll just take these one at a time. The key consideration about secondary and primary education. We have not done a detailed study on this, but if you look at the countries that are in the active TNE grouping, you'll find that they have very strong pre-university education system. And if you compare this to the World Bank data, you'll find the correlation there. So I think you're right. It's very important to have very strong primary and secondary education in order to feed into TNE. Research ecosystem, I must say, I'm going to tie that up with the answer for private higher education research. Countries like Malaysia, I can only talk for Malaysia, we are a very young nation, 56 years old, I think, very young. Our universities are very young. Research is really the furthest in our mind, when TNE was developing. But today there seems to be greater emphasis placed on research. So research is growing, and TNE is helping to push research to the forefront. So I think that's happening. Now, what encourages research in Malaysia, particularly in the private sector? All universities today will have to compete for funding from the ministry, private and public universities. We are involved in about 4 different research at any one time. But the number of researchers are very small because most of the private universities are largely teaching universities. So we are trying to push and get people to get involved in research. But with the support from partner universities, TNE partners, we seem to see this number growing. So perhaps another 5 years' time, we see research being one of the main perhaps mission or perhaps vision of the private universities. I can foresee that. Now, lastly, to receiving countries, why US is not popular? I think it's historical for Malaysia, Singapore, Hong Kong. It's historical. I mean, we had links with UK, all leaders, if we look at political leaders, institutional leaders, vice chancellors, they would have probably got a degree from UK or one of the Commonwealth countries, UK and Australia. So usually TNE started off because I knew someone from the university and then I brought them into the country. And this is proven in one of our studies earlier. So I think this is because of historical reasons. Yeah.
Okay. You want to comment? Am I live? Quick comment. About the U.S., only in relationship to branch campuses, if you look at the OBHE data, the Observatory for Borderless Higher Education, there are 200 branch campuses operating, 33 being planned. 78 of those 200 come from the U.S. So, in fact, the U.S. is active, mm-hmm. but perhaps more active in the branch campus mm-hmm. perspective than in any of the collaborative programs. However, if you look at the data coming from the U.S. around double and joint degree programs, that is increasing significantly as well. Okay, I would say a second round. Is it still possible? Okay, over here. No? One more round. Okay.
Yeah. I'm from Bangladesh, member of the National Skills Development Council. What surprised me is that Bangladesh is not on your mapping. I wonder why, because a lot of our students are going abroad for higher education. So I think we are a fit candidate to include in your studies, because we are also thinking of going into partnerships with foreign universities, etc. And also we're looking at the possibility of developing an education and knowledge skills city in the country. So I would appreciate if you put Bangladesh on that map.
Sure. So we started off with 50 countries, actually, and Bangladesh was one of those countries. We actually did carry out a study on Bangladesh about a year ago, and we're quite familiar with the TNE environment in Bangladesh. And, we just T&E in Bangladesh is mostly about tuition providers delivering programs, so like the University of London programs, distance learning programs. So there's quite a bit of distance learning going on, but not very much branch campus activity. So we were looking for countries that had at least some kind of critical mass. So Bangladesh is probably, you know, a little bit earlier on in the development stages for T&E for us to have included in this study. But I mean, I am aware that there's quite a bit of developments on the regulatory side. All right, there was an act going through last year. I don't know, was it passed on facilitating T&E? Not yet. Oh yeah, okay. So.
Maybe next year if we update them to study.
Well, exactly. No, it was close.
Yeah. Okay. So I mean, meet next time. Okay. We will have it on the agenda. So thank you so much. I think it was really exciting. It's far too much information to wrap it up. A great thank you to all of you. And we are looking forward to the internet and to get more information. Excellent. Thank you so much.
This is a podcast from the British Council's Going Global 2013.